The time is now. Hello, everybody. Volume 1, Episode 11. This is Employment Law Now, and I am Mike Schmidt, Vice Chair of the Labor and Employment Department at Cozen O'Connor. So, did you miss me at all? I know you did. For those of you who have been loyal listeners to this podcast since we started it in the beginning of February, I know you were probably thinking to yourself 2 weeks ago, where's Mike? Where's Employment Law Now? How am I getting some great Employment Law Now updates? Well, we missed the early July episode of the podcast due to some technical glitches, some technical difficulties. I'd like to be able to blame it on the heat wave that is coming at least to the New York area. But in any event, I am sorry for having to have missed the early July episode, but we are back. And the good news is that now that we are back, we really come back in style. We really come back in grand fashion with something so big that we had to break this one into a two-part episode, sort of like my own little mini-series. I am really thrilled to have as my special outside guest now segment David Lopez, who is joining me as the former general counsel of the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, as you all know. David Lopez was actually the longest serving general counsel of the EEOC in its history. He has been so gracious to agree to sit down and talk with me about a whole wide range of topics. And again, because he was able to sit down and spend so much time with me, I've broken it into two parts. So the first part will be in today's podcast episode, and then part two will be in our next episode that gets released 2 weeks from now. For those of you who know this already, I'm sorry, but it's important to give you a little bit of David's background. He served as the EEOC's general counsel for about 6 years, from April 2010 until December 2016, having been nominated twice by President Obama and confirmed by the Senate, both in 2010 and 2014. He was actually the first EEOC field trial attorney ever to be appointed as the agency's general counsel. Prior to joining the EEOC, David was a senior trial attorney at the U.S. Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., specifically with the DOJ's Civil Rights Division, the Employment Litigation Section. And for those keeping track of our government agency leaders, you know that David just left the EEOC to join the well-renowned employee side law firm of Outen & Golden, where he heads up their D.C. office. As I said, we're going to talk about a whole wide range of topics, both in today's part one and then in the next episode's part two. We're going to talk about how the EEOC decides what cases to take on, what you as a company should be doing when the EEOC comes knocking at your door, and whether David believes that the EEOC has become somewhat more activist and more pro-employee over the years. You'll remember back in April when I had the opportunity to interview the NLRB's general counsel, Richard Griffin. I asked him that question to sort of address the employer perception out there that the EEOC has become much more of a pro-employee activist government agency. So I'm interested in David's take on that same question when it comes to the EEOC. I'm also going to spend some time going through a whole list of substantive issues that the EEOC has taken on recently, such as transgender status, equal pay, companies using an employee or an applicant's look to decide whether to hire him or her. So these are a couple of episodes that you're not going to want to miss, I hope, and the fact that you're actually listening to me right now suggests that you're not going to be missing anything. So thanks so much for listening. Keep your comments and your questions coming to me. You can email me at mschmidt@cozen.com. You can also go to our dedicated website, employmentlawnow.com. Tell us what you like, what you don't like, what kind of topics you want to hear in future episodes, and we are definitely listening to you. So without further ado, here is part one of my two-part sit-down interview with David Lopez. David, thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
My pleasure.
It's really great to have you, and I think we're going to give the listeners some great insight and some knowledge based on your experience with the EEOC, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's do it.
So right before you announced your departure from the EEOC in October 2016, the EEOC approved an updated strategic enforcement plan for fiscal years 2017 to 2021 that continues to prioritize certain issues such as systemic harassment and discrimination. What is it about systemic cases that's made them a priority for the EEOC, and what has the EEOC done from a strategic standpoint in that area?
Well, just as background, let me start out and talk about the strategic enforcement plan, because some of your listeners may not be familiar with it. The strategic enforcement plan, among other objectives, sets forth the commission's enforcement priorities for the years 2017 through 2020. What does it mean to set forth the enforcement priorities? It means the commission will use all of the tools at its disposal to address those issues. Now, it's important for your listeners to remember that the EEOC's mission is not to litigate, but to eradicate employment discrimination. And so those tools include outreach and education, the development of policy and technical assistance in the hopes of securing voluntary compliance from the employer community, investigation, mediation, and conciliation. And if all of those methods do not work, then litigation. And so the Commission's Strategic Enforcement Plan sets forth six priorities, and those priorities include systemic hiring discrimination, because I think the belief was that the EEOC is really well situated to address issues of hiring discrimination because it's able to look for broad patterns, and it has subpoena authority, it's able to really test an employer's purported reasons for making certain hiring decisions. So the EEOC, as a law enforcement agency, is better situated, I think, than the private bar. It includes systemic harassment, and I think that was partly due to the surprise of some of the commissioners as to the persistence of egregious harassment in the 21st century. And so they really wanted to kind of double down and make sure that we addressed harassment and try to extricate it once and for all from the American workplace.
Is the systemic issue a product of, you know, resources and the best way to use resources, or is the systemic issue, you know, really something that's more of a problem to the EEOC than an individual by individual basis?
Yeah, let me talk about that. When the EEOC was created, it was created to enforce Title VII. Title VII is written very broadly, and there was really no definition for the term discrimination, and the early individuals who worked at the EEOC viewed discrimination, as well as I think a good part of the civil rights community, as really a structural issue, a systemic issue dealing with, for instance, seniority systems that froze whites into certain upper well-paying positions. Exams that didn't have anything to do, that had a disproportionate exclusive effect on African Americans or women, but then didn't have anything to do with the actual job that was being tested for. And so the EEOC focused very much on the structural issues, and that's really carried throughout most of the EEOC's history. There was a respite, probably from 1980, through the early 90s, when I think there's much more focus on individual discrimination. But even then, there were offices that were very focused on systemic cases. And then in 2006, under the leadership of Chair Kerry Dominguez and Commissioner Leslie Silberman, the EEOC established a systemic litigation, systemic task force to focus on how to improve its systemic enforcement. And that was a good government move. Okay, that was like, okay, we have limited resources. How can we best use these limited resources to have the broadest possible impact in terms of eradicating discrimination? And I think during the time when I was there, from 2010 onward, there was a real focus on, again, systemic discrimination. And systemic is any case that will have a broad impact on an industry or geographic region or an employment practice. So there's a real effort to, you know, develop systemic cases and to really push systemic enforcement. But it's always a work in progress. And so there's a lot of, you know, assessment and reassessment in terms of what works. When I got there, you know, we filed several nationwide cases. I think during the latter years, there weren't as many nationwide cases. I think some of the cases were more regionally focused or more surgically focused on certain practices. But it has been a big part of the EEOC.
And in terms of giving employers, I guess, a sense of the behind the scenes and how an agency like the EEOC ticks, how does the EEOC go about setting its strategic plan and determining what areas, whether it's an issue, whether it's an industry, but what areas it's going to focus on?
Yeah, let me talk a little bit about that, because I was very involved in the strategic enforcement plan for the years 2012 through 2016. I was one of the chairs of the committee that helped develop that plan. But what you need to remember is that at the end of the day, it is the commission, the bipartisan commission, that votes on the plan. And even David Lopez, as the general counsel, did not have a vote. You know, I was there really sort of help develop ideas behind the plan.
And policy issues.
And the policy issues, right? And we work, you know, very closely, I think, with both the internal and the external stakeholders. And I think what the EEOC did with the strategic enforcement priorities is that some of the priorities were sort of natural for the agency, such as hiring discrimination, because it's much easier for the EEOC with its subpoena authority and investigatory authority to address those forms of discrimination. There were other issues, such as its focus on discrimination against vulnerable workers, where the agency had been doing that work in certain offices for several years, and the idea was, okay, let's see if we can build upon the strengths of those offices and build a nationwide capacity to address those issues, right? And remember, this is not just in terms of enforcement, this is also in terms of outreach, this mm-hmm. is in terms of public education. I think harassment is another area. I mean, I think there was sort of the sense that if we wanted, we could do harassment cases 24/7. And so I know that some of the commissioners, and that would include Commissioners Lipnick and Bellbloom, who worked on a year-long harassment task force where they wanted to sort of get underneath the issue and figure out if there were new and innovative things that employers could do or that employees could do, you know, short of enforcement to address harassment. But it wasn't as though the EEOC wasn't bringing harassment cases. And then there's some issues, probably most notably the emerging issue focus on LGBT coverage, where not a lot of people had really thought about that. I think there were some folks in our federal sector who had thought about that issue, and maybe, you know, I know I had a wonderful staff member who's now with our New York office who, you know, started to think about issues of coverage and reframing Title VII's prohibition against sex discrimination. But some of that was aspirational at first, but what it did is it really kind of triggered a redoubled effort to, I think, look at issues of coverage nationwide.
And just going back to the harassment task force issue, what are the things that the EEOC traditionally like to see from employers when it comes to how they deal with harassment issues, how they address harassment issues when they arise? What's the EEOC really looked at when they're deciding whether an employer is complying with the law?
Well, I mean, I someone who's not with the agency anymore, I hate to try to speak for the EEOC, but I think, you know, certainly leadership at the very top is extremely important. It's important for...
Sort of the buy-in, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's important for corporate leadership at the highest levels to make it clear that harassment won't be tolerated, to make sure that there are multiple avenues to complain about harassment, to make sure that there's, you know, prompt and effective remedial action, you know, as well. And so I think that's something that's very important, you know, and I think obviously another important aspect dealing with all aspects of discrimination is to make sure that there is no retaliation, that it's very important that Title VII's and the ADA and the anti-discrimination laws prohibition against retaliation is taken seriously, because I think, you know, most labor and employment lawyers are very familiar with the scenario where perhaps the discrimination case is not that strong, but a jury will come back with a very, very stiff verdict on a retaliation claim. And I think for that reason, one of the EEOC's six priorities is preservation of access to the legal system. It's just very important that an employer make sure that everyone understands that it's serious, that people have the right to complain, they have the right to come forward, and there should be no retaliation.
It's interesting. That retaliation issue is something we addressed in an earlier podcast episode. It always seemed to me that retaliation used to be a sister cause of action that you see in a complaint. But now when you look at the EEOC statistics from the past few years, you look at the number of charges for retaliation-based complaints compared to other charges filed, and retaliation really is something that needs to be taken seriously by employers.
Absolutely. And one thing, you know, just to, I think, highlight the way that the strategic enforcement plan was really focused on all of the EEOC's tools is that a couple years ago, the EEOC updated its compliance manual section on retaliation. The compliance manual is really designed to guide the investigators, but it's shared publicly so the public understands how the EEOC is interpreting the various anti-discrimination laws. And so one of the compliance manual section updates that that former Chair Yang spearheaded was on retaliation. And I think at the same time, you saw a lot of cases. You saw this a Sixth Circuit case, EEOC versus New Breed, where the Sixth Circuit, you know, addressing an unaddressed, a previously unaddressed issue, says that it is protected activity when an employee tells a supervisor harasser, "I do not want to be harassed." That is protected activity. The employee is not obligated to go to a third party to complain about harassment if the harasser is the supervisor. And so that was, you know, I think one of the important legal developments that the EEOC pushed.
Now that's interesting. And so going, I guess, to the procedural aspect of this, most of the companies out there, I think, are familiar enough with the EEOC when they get an administrative charge that's filed with the EEOC, and then the company will get notice of that charge and have to respond through a position statement. But I think a lot of people still don't have a sense of why certain cases are brought by the EEOC itself through its own litigation. Why and when would the EEOC typically bring a case on its own as the plaintiff?
Well, that issue is a little complex. It's important to remember that the EEOC has 15 district offices across the country, and the district director is in charge of the investigations and basically the operational details of the office. The regional attorney is in charge of the litigation program. And the leadership at the district level is really charged with having, you know, with trying to have the maximum deterrent effect on discrimination, using all of the tools at its disposal. So that means that, you know, I think the expectation is that the district offices will make sure it covers the district geographically. So, for instance, the New York district includes Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine and upstate New York. So it's important that the cases aren't just concentrated in New York City, but they're across the district. It's important that, you know, that an office doesn't file only cases only under one statute, only disability discrimination cases. So there's a real effort to make sure that you are filing cases under all of the statutes, that you are representing the communities, that you're responding, I think, to the needs and the forms of discrimination in that community. And I think that in terms of the litigation decision, the reason that's important is because there is really kind of a three-tier litigation approval process. For certain cases, those cases involve a substantial devotion of resources, cases that involve areas where the EFC has not weighed in on policy, where the litigation itself might develop policy, sort of these cutting-edge cases, such as issues of coverage of gender identity, at the beginning, not now, or cases that are likely to generate public controversy. All those cases need to be approved by the entire five-member commission. Below that level is are smaller class cases, certain ADA cases that involve portions of the ADA that haven't been fully developed. Those cases are all subject to general counsel approval. And then below that, litigation authority has been, loosely delegated to the district offices to make sure that they are addressing the needs in the community. So what that means is that there's less bureaucracy in terms of the approval process. You're able to get into court quickly. You don't have people in Washington sort of making top-down decisions in terms of what goes on. Now, what's very important, and this used to get me in trouble sometimes when I was at the commission, is it's important to remember that even within the structure of delegated authority, that there is oversight by the general counsel's office, that every single case that goes into litigation is reviewed by the general counsel's office. But I think the best way to think about it is really the level of scrutiny that a case will receive. If it's something that's under delegated authority, it'll be a much more cursory review, because I think that the managerial idea is to, to give the local leadership latitude. If it's something at the DC level, will be, greater scrutiny, and if it's something that's going to be sent to the commission and be subject to the review by five commissioners and their staff. I mean, if when it goes to the commission, it's like 27 people look at it, right?
It's not just one person sitting behind a desk.
Yeah, there's a lot of review, and it's much more, I think, bureaucratic. But it's important to have those road bumps for those types of cases because the consequences of those cases going south, affect the whole program, affect the entire agency.
And when you were there, where did you believe the EEOC's appropriate place was, more in terms of creating and setting policy, or more in terms of enforcing what courts have already said or what the EEOC had previously determined should be the policy?
I mean, I think it's important that question is not as easy as the way it's been framed. And I think one of the reasons that many people become lawyers is because the line between applying the law and developing the law is often very elusive, right?
Mm-hmm. Because I think
as plaintiff's lawyers, we certainly saw some pretty bold moves by the defense bar in terms of EFC's administrative responsibilities that were really sort of unprecedented and involved what we believe to be areas that had been well established by the courts, yet sometimes the courts pick up those ideas and then it sort of spreads. I think the best example to sort of illustrate this is the whole issue of the coverage of sexual orientation under Title VII.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly when I started in 2010, I had people whispering in my ear, don't touch that, that's politically dangerous. Certainly the commentators were saying, every single appellate court that has looked at that issue has found that sexual orientation isn't covered by Title VII.
It's not covered, the original,
it's not
right.
By Title VII, right? And I think, I think that was in many respects the conventional wisdom. But I think that the commission, through the work of many people at the agency, from the commissioners to the line lawyers in our Office of Federal Operations to our litigators in the field, really started to think about how to reframe that issue in light of very important Supreme Court precedent, namely Price Waterhouse and Uncalli. And really formulated an argument that set forth in the Commission's Baldwin Federal Sector decision as to why sexual orientation is covered. And then what you've seen is that that argument that has slowly gained traction at the district court level. There was a district court in Western District of Pennsylvania that that adopted the position, and then recently, recently this year, the Seventh Circuit, sitting in Bonk, you know, basically adopted the position that sexual orientation is covered by Title VII. So that's an area where people would criticize us as, hey, that's overreach. But now we have a Seventh Circuit decision signed by notable judicial conservatives such as, you know, Judge Easterbrook and Judge Posner, you know, basically agreeing with the position. So it, you know, that whole issue can be very elusive. And one of the things that I think really surprised me when I was at the commission is we started to go back to the text of the statute, because I think we started to believe generally that fidelity to the text was something that would promote enforcement of the anti-discrimination laws, and that the barriers that we often face were sort of these judicial constructions of stray remarks doctrine or same actor inference or whatever, and that if you stuck with the statute, that in many respects you'd have more success. But what was pretty amazing is that if you look at Title VII, if you look at the codification of disparate impact in 1991, if you look at the American with Disabilities Act, prohibitions against interference, there are really large portions of all of the anti-discrimination statutes that are pretty underdeveloped, where there is just very, very little case law. Yet you have these statutory pronouncements by Congress expressing the will of the people, right? And so, you know, so I think the commission would push those. The commission would push the meaning of the statutes. And sometimes we're criticized for overreach or trying to develop the law or flouting the will of Congress. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we have to take the best position possible. And if the courts disagree with us, as has happened, you know, then Congress can come in and change the position, as has happened frequently, such as with pregnancy discrimination. The ESC took the position that pregnancy discrimination was covered by Title VII. The Supreme Court in Gilbert disagreed. Congress came back and amended the statute. And so I think the ESC's position is to really take, you know, positions of good faith and push the positions. And it operates within, I think, a separation of powers where there are checks and balances.
And I think that leads very nicely to this question that I've been dying to ask you, because I asked the same question to General Counsel Richard Griffin back in April about the community's perception of the National Labor Relations Board. Many employers, as I posited to Mr. Griffin, I think many employers have developed the belief, rightly or wrongly, that the EEOC is one of those government agencies that has become very activist and very pro-employee. How would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I think as general counsel, it was actually my job to enforce the anti-discrimination laws, right? And so I would plead guilty, because I think we try to do that as responsibly and as successfully as possible. You know, I think that what's really interesting about the EEOC is that it enforces five statutes, and those statutes cover every worker in the United States, right? Every single worker in the United States. And so sometimes it's easy to sort of develop a meme that the EEOC is an activist agency and forget that, no, these statutes potentially protect me if I'm subject, you know, if I'm over 40 and subject to age discrimination, if I'm moved out of my law firm because, you know, I hit a certain age, or if I'm, you know, pregnant, or if I hit the glass ceiling and am not able to get a promotion, whereas men are able to get the promotions. One of the things that was really kind of amusing for me is that one of the last cases that I was involved with at the EEOC was a case involving sexual harassment, racial harassment, and then there was a person who worked at this car lot in a managerial position who opposed the harassment and was subjected to, you know, some form of retaliation. And at the end of the day, he gets a pretty good chunk of money. And he calls me up and he says, I'm really proud that you were nominated by President Obama. I'm very proud that we worked together. He goes, but just do me a favor. I'm like, what is that? He goes, don't become a socialist. And so I start laughing. And I'm like, don't become a socialist. I said, you just got a good chunk of change,
right?
With free government services. And he just starts laughing. He goes, ironies abound, don't they? And he laughed, right? He goes, ironies abound. But that's sort of how this, you know, this works, is that, you know, we've had cases, you know, obviously against law firms for mandatory arbitration that deals with, you know, very well-heeled employees. We've had cases against, one of the most famous cases out of New York City was the case against Morgan Stanley. But we also, you know, have really made our mark and have been recognized for fighting on behalf of some of the most humble and vulnerable members of the economy, immigrant women, farm workers, women subject to sexual harassment and abuse. And so the anti-discrimination laws affect everyone, and it's, in a way it's really everyone's interest, I think, for the agency to be, to care about giving meaning and content to those laws that Congress passed.
So there's nothing that's really changed, it sounds like, over the past few years that would have fueled that kind of perception from employers.
Well, I mean, I think every administration has a different cast, and I think one thing that's interesting is that there are certainly cases that, you know, that we brought that perhaps another administration would not have brought, and those cases had turned out successfully, and some cases have turned out not successfully. Right. So,
is that a good thing? I mean, is it a good thing for the EEOC to potentially change what it's deciding to take or bring every 4 years, every 8 years, depending on the administration?
Well, I mean, I think there's.
I mean, I'm oversimplifying that, obviously, but
yeah, there's always an element. I mean, there's always an element of prosecutorial discretion in terms of what you bring, and you know, I think the way that I looked at it is that it's very easy for, when you litigate in the federal courts, you litigate publicly, you litigate in the sunshine, right? So I could never go into a bar conference and say we win all our cases, because anybody could get on their phone and say, well, you lost this one and you won this one, right?
And they'd be happy to say that to you.
Right, and certainly, you know, I've been in front of Congress and they've mentioned you've lost this one and this one and this one, right? But when you win the case has a public education function, the case has a deterrent function, mm-hmm. the case is high profile, such as the EEOC's case against Abercrombie, which is one of the best known, I think, religious discrimination cases. It was an 8-1 Scalia decision, right? You know, and that has a public education function and a deterrent function, and we operate in the public realm, okay? But the thing is that if you lose in the public realm, everybody knows it, right? Okay, and you know, it'll be in the Wall Street Journal, it'll be in the press, whatever. Okay, but if you do not bring a case, if you leave enforcement opportunities on the table, right, if you say, I don't want to lose and have the press write about it and become overly cautious, then that's often hidden from the public view.
Sure.
And you're not held accountable necessarily, I think we should be, but my experience was, you know, we were never held accountable for enforcement opportunities that were left on the table. But I think all enforcement agencies, not just us, the SEC, you know, certainly the SEC was criticized for certain things it has not done, right? But, you know, I think the EEOC likewise, you know, has a responsibility not to leave enforcement opportunities off the table, not to leave victims of discrimination unremedied. We can't help everybody. We have to make decisions, yes. But, you know, my job as a general counsel was to, you know, to bring cases responsibly. And I think we had many successes that I think the public, you know, the public is familiar with. The Abercrombie case, the Hively case on sexual orientation, LGBT coverage, the Henry's Turkeys case, the $240 million verdict involving 32 intellectually disabled workers from Texas, right? Mm-hmm. There is a scenario where that case would not have been approved or brought, right? And that would have been a shame, because mm-hmm. that case generated, first of all, a front page story in the New York Times and a book, but also attention from the international human rights community, And, you know, there's a scenario where, you know, perhaps a more cautious administration or a more cautious regional attorney, you know, would have just sort of sat on that case and looked the other way.
And so before I hit you on some of the specific or the substantive issues, some of which you started talking about, I just want to wrap up the procedural aspect of this. When the EEOC does come knocking on the company's door, either in the form of a charge or in the EEOC's own litigation, what is the best thing a company can do from your perspective when the EEOC does come knocking on the company door? Certainly they shouldn't be ignoring the knock.
Yeah, no, they shouldn't ignore the knock, and they should, you know, they should cooperate, and they should maintain their credibility in terms of the arguments they make. I think statistically, you know, most investigations do not result in cause determinations, and you know, the EEOC will look at stuff and sometimes just not develop sufficient evidence. You know, but I think, you know, I think this is true in any type of law enforcement setting, but the minute you start to damage your credibility, then, you know, it'll raise eyebrows and, you know, it'll often, I think, generate increased attention. So, you know, I think the best thing is really, you know, to be honest and to cooperate and to try to work through the issues. And I think one of the things that happened at the EEOC, I think one of the unsung successes is that the EEOC actually became increasingly successful at conciliating and mediating cases informally. So what that says is that it improved its credibility as a law enforcement agency with the employer community. The employer community, many in the employer community, stood up to the plate and said, okay, we have a problem, let's try to resolve this problem without litigation. And that was happening in larger and larger numbers when I left.
Great. And so I want to talk about a few specific issues in particular that are on the minds of employers. The first one is one that you've mentioned a couple of times now. It was one of the more well-known cases recently brought by the EEOC in 2015 against Abercrombie & Fitch that involved a refusal to hire based on a company's look policy. When there didn't seem to be any evidence that the issue of the applicant's religious practices ever even came up during the interview process. Why was this such a big issue for the EEOC, and how should employers look at their own dress code policies?
Well, I mean, I think the case actually kind of tapped into a chord in the public imagination. You know, when the case went up to the Supreme Court, and, you know, I talk about this case publicly a lot, it involved a couple of almost irresistible elements. It involved a young woman who, you know, when she was 17, applied at Abercrombie and Fitch, Abercrombie and Kids, and was denied the job. She was denied the job because the district manager, you know, found out that she was wearing a hijab during the interview for religious reasons and said lower her score, right? So she's someone who has a question of principle and conscience, you know, was able to take her case with the help of our tiny little agency all the way to the Supreme Court. That's a pretty inspiring story. But it also touched a chord about how we view ourselves as Americans, because it dealt with issues of religious pluralism and tolerance. And one thing that is very notable about the case is that we had amicus support from just about every religious denomination, from Jewish groups, from Muslim groups, from the Christian Legal Defense Fund and the Beckett Fund, you know, groups that don't always agree with the EEOC.
And they were submitting briefs in this case.
And they're submitting briefs. And it led one publication to say that the Abercrombie case had united the world's religions, right? It had done something no one else had been able to do. And that, again, goes back to the point that, you know, these laws help everyone, right? These laws help everyone. You know, I think in terms of the actual technical issue, at the end of the day, when Justice Scalia read the decision from the bench, he said, this is an easy case. It's an easy case because there's evidence of discriminatory animus. There's evidence that she was denied an accommodation because they knew that she wanted a religious accommodation. She was denied a job because the employer knew she wanted a religious accommodation. So it was the element of intent that was there in the record. But again, to take it back to your other question about applying the law and developing the law, Justice Scalia, speaking for 8 members of the Supreme Court, only Justice Thomas dissented, said, this is an easy case. One of the more notably conservative justices said, this is an easy case. It's important to remember that the Tenth Circuit thought it was easy, but in the other
way.
in the other direction, and they weren't particularly nice about it. And that when the EOC sought rehearing in Bonk with the Tenth Circuit split 5-5, and one of the five members of the Tenth Circuit voting against rehearing the case was now Justice Gorsuch, right? Supposedly, you know, the you know, inspired by Justice
the next Scalia, right?
And so, you know, these are complex issues at the end of the day, and you know, I think we're all in it because we know that that people can have good faith disagreements about what the law says, but that's what courts are for, right?
To absolutely
to sort of develop it. So at the end of the day, the court says it's an easy case. The EOC pushed out a technical assistance guidance. So again, this is the voluntary compliance side to help employers navigate garb and grooming policies because, you know, it'll be an issue, it'll continue to be an issue. The Abercrombie Court never really got to the whole undue hardship argument that was raised below. And so, you know, these are complex issues, they'll continue to be complex issues. But, you know, certainly that case led to, you know, I think a lot of, it was sort of viewed as an affirmation of our country's history of religious tolerance and religious pluralism.
And the EEOC certainly has put out, as you said, the technical guidance, and employers can certainly take a look at that and have access to that. To the extent any of this can be whittled down to a nutshell, from your time at the EEOC, was there something in particular that the EEOC would look at, a dress policy that a company maintained, and say, all right, this is something we're okay with versus this is just blatantly a problem? Or is it not that simple?
I don't know if it's that simple because, remember, you know, I would see the cases, I would see the cases more at the tail end, so I didn't see perhaps the cases that were dismissed. I saw the cases that where a determination had already been made by leadership at the district level that, you know, there was an issue. And so it's important to remember that these cases involve not just Samantha Eloff and, you know, her religious belief that she should wear hijab, but also involve, you know, Pentecostals wearing, you know, long dresses at Whataburger. There was another case that was recently affirmed by the Fourth Circuit that involved the use of a hand scanner and someone who was a fundamentalist Christian who had objections to submitting to a hand scan for religious reasons, and they could have accommodated him very easily. We won a big jury verdict in West Virginia that was affirmed by the Fourth Circuit. So, you know, this really covers all of the religions. I think at one time when I was in the field office, I had a case involving a Muslim woman, a Jewish teenager who was suspended for wearing a yarmulke at Blockbuster, and a Christian evangelical who was fired for violating the company's anti-fraternization policy by participating in Bible study with some of her colleagues outside of work.
Well, that was really great, and I hope you've gotten some useful information. But again, as I said at the beginning of this episode, this is just the beginning. We continue our conversation with David Lopez in our next episode. In part two, we're going to be going further into some substantive issues that the EEOC has taken on. We're going to get into some Equal Pay Act issues. We're going to talk about age discrimination. This is the 50th birthday of the Age Discrimination in Employment Act. We're going to talk about the proposed merger between the EEOC and the OFCCP. And for those who don't know exactly what both of those acronyms are, we're going to talk about that in some depth with David. And then finally, we're going to go through a little bit about what David thinks of the new nominee. Trump just nominated Janet Dillon as the chair of the EEOC. And I'll ask David what his thoughts are and where we can expect the EEOC to be going in the coming months and years. So thank you so much for listening to this episode. Remember to tune in again in 2 weeks, and we'll finish this two-part interview with David Lopez. Until then, I hope all of your labor is productive.